This program is made possible by the friends and partners of Curator Ministries.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to the table. You're here with Pastor Maria Reynolds. I am in the studio today with my producer, Sam, my husband, Doug, and our wonderful friend, Judge Dan O'Hanlon. Judge O'Hanlon has been a friend of our family for many years now. Doug, you and he forged a friendship, fast friends, years ago. Though I don't get to spend much time in your presence, I get to hear lots about you through my husband. He thinks so much of you and really values your friendship as well as your guidance. And he finds you as well as I do to be quite the Renaissance man. You were one of the longest serving circuit court judges in Cabell County, a national chess champion.
I am that.
Yes.
Got my picture on the front page of the chess magazine.
Legal Beagle. Legal Beagle.
It was something. Yeah. It was a great moment.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You also have a broad range of you're also very versed in a broad range of subjects, including law, politics, technology, education, as well as your newest, well, that new to me, beekeeping.
Oh, I've been a beekeeper for a long time.
Really?
And I was beekeeper of the year the same year I was judge of the year in West Virginia, and I had to tell him that I was more proud to be beekeeper of the year.
So what got you into beekeeping? That's so interesting.
Another fellow who was upstairs from me in the, where I had I was downstairs in the court, and he was upstairs doing all kinds of stuff for agriculture and everything. And he took me to his house and said he would show me the bees. And I said, I don't want to go anywhere near bees. Are you think I'm crazy? They'll sting me. He said, nope. So they put the suit on you, you know, and you go right up and you're right there and they're buzzing all around, but they never sting you. I said, well, they are fascinating. I need to get some of those bees. And I've been keeping bees ever since. And I got to the point where I had 120 beehives, and I was selling honey in the west side on Saturday mornings. I'd go there at 5 in the morning and start selling my honey, and sold bees in the spring. And anyway, now when I turned 70, I'm about to be 76. When I turned 70, I retired, so I'm helping other people, but...
Wow.
No more bees. I have 10 beehives, but that's all.
Yeah.
Just my wife likes to give away honey at Christmas and that kind of thing.
Wow. So when did you get started in, you graduated law school, and you mentioned off air that you started your career as a judge earlier than most.
Yeah. When you're in law school and you get to the end of your second year, most people spend the following summer going to the kind of place where there's lawyers that they want to do. If you're a one that does criminal cases, you want to go to one that does criminal cases. If they do cases that involve companies, you want to go to one of those. And I couldn't decide. Everything was so fascinating to me. And so I went to, the professor who was the one that I went to, and he said, well, I'll tell you what. We can actually put you with a judge this summer, and you'll see all kinds of different things coming in front of this judge. I was in Phoenix, Arizona at the time, and so I went with a judge. He was a wonderful man, very nice to me. And when he was done, I said, well, I know what I want to be when I grow up. I want to be one of these judges. Because in the United States of America, you can do what you want in Washington, D.C. You can do what you want in all the states and in their legislatures. But in the end, it ends up in a court.
Oh.
And goes all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. And it's the judges who make the final decision. And I thought, well, I certainly want to be one of those. So when I graduated, I went and spent a year with a federal judge. And because of the federal judge, I got a job with the United States lawyers in Washington, D.C. Stayed there for 5 years till my dad died. And then I decided it was time to go. And my wife and I enjoyed West Virginia so much. She was from Tucson and I was from Phoenix. And but we loved coming over here. We loved whitewater rafting and all the nice people. So we came over here, but I said, I'm going to teach. I'm not sure that we're going to make it here in West Virginia. So I went and taught at Marshall University. Did it for 8 years as the chairman of criminal justice to teach paralegals how to be paralegals. So during that time, 2 years after I got here, they made me the judge in two evenings at the city. And so I got to go and do things at the city two nights a week. And I just loved being that judge. So at the end of 8 years, it was time for another one for the full-time job of the circuit judges. And I decided that I'd run. And people said, you're not from here. You didn't go to high school or grade school here. You didn't go to college here. Nobody, you know. And I said, well, still, I've been trying to meet a lot of people. And when I ran first.
Wow.
And I became a judge at age 36.
Wow.
Youngest ever in the history of West Virginia at the time. Usually it's older lawyers that come and do it. So that's how I got started, and I've loved it ever since.
Wow.
Matter of fact, I'm still doing it to this day because I retired when I was 62. But the Supreme Court has a thing where they can make you a senior status judge, which means that if they have a problem, someone gets ill suddenly, someone resigns suddenly, something happens, they ask one of us to go in and fill in. I mean, they pay us to do it, but still they ask us to do it. And I thought we all did that, but 3 months ago, I was at a judge's conference, and the Chief Justice came to me. She was a woman last year, and she said, I really appreciate that you're still doing this, Judge O'Hanlon. I said, what are you talking about? I thought everybody did it. She said, nope. There's 69 judges here. Eventually, all of them retire, but there's only 12 of you that are willing to do this, or that we're willing to have.
Yeah.
So anyway, I said, okay, well, that's interesting. But at least you got 12. She said, no, that's my big problem. 8 of them, as soon as it gets cold, go down to Florida until April. So she said, now I've got 4 of you, and the other 3 are up in the mountains, and they're not coming to a place like Huntington. It's too far away. So you go to Charleston, you go to Huntington, you do wherever I ask you, you go. And I said, well, I'm happy to do it. I'll do it as long as I can.
Wow.
So I'm still doing it.
Wow.
I did two and a half to three months just a few months ago when Chris Childs suddenly had a heart attack and had to leave suddenly.
Wow. What do you think when you said that to me or said that to us that you were 36 and that was an untraditional route that most men and women take when they want to enter that level of the judicial system? Oftentimes you hear, I'm the college minister here, so oftentimes I hear my students say, I'm disqualified because of my age. I hear that too often. I'm too young. Do you think that there was any strength that you had or benefit that you had entering that realm at such a young age?
Yep, and it was my good luck, but it's one that I thought of, and that's this. There were a lot of people that were lost in the generation that went into World War II, unfortunately. A lot of them just didn't make it back, and if they didn't, their wife didn't have a lot of kids while they were gone for 4 or 5 years. Well, when they got back, boy, did they ever have kids. And that is the biggest bunch of kids that ever were, in the 40s and early 50s. The boomers, they call them, because they just boomed wide. There's probably 2 or 3 times more people. Well, guess what? That's my group, and they were old enough to vote.
That's good. That's good.
So I think that really helped me. And the fact that I taught at Marshall University, they all knew me. I was on the board there. So I think I got a lot of people who voted for me who were at Marshall University, and that's many, many thousands of people.
Yeah.
So.
Well, too, and coming from a political background, my husband was in politics for many years, and that is one divide that oftentimes people have a hard time bridging is, well, you're not from here. You said you were not from West Virginia originally. How do you think you bridged that gap with voters?
Well, I never said I'm not from here.
I never owned that.
If they asked, I wasn't going to lie, but nobody ever asked. They assumed I was here because I talk like them and walk like them and dressed like them. And I was at Marshall University, so I must be from here.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I didn't go bragging, well, I'm not from here. Why would I?
Yeah. That's interesting. I wonder if that's just a cultural thing that's unique to our Appalachia, or if that's something that's just universal, that almost like an us against them. Does that make sense? Do you pick that up in society at all?
It's happening now. We're in that group again, the group that I was, just coming out of. There's a lot of young people now who are really unhappy about people who are president and who might be president. I mean, they're very, very... it's changing. Normally, my parents always voted their whole lives for the same thing. Not anymore. This is going through this 15, 20 years, I think. It's going to be very, very turbulent.
What's interesting that you say that, and I was talking to one of my students last week, and that was kind of the genesis of my thinking for the past week or two, was she was sitting at a religious retreat with, it was a melting pot of different denominations, and that she mentioned that one of the leaders got up and said of what she found to be a very divisive thing, that he said, you can't possibly go to heaven or be a Christian and be a Democrat. And so when you said that about the voters just assuming that you were from West Virginia, I think we make those types of assumptions so often. And given the new political climate that I feel like we're probably going to enter into again if history repeats itself, I fear it will be another divisive one. And what's interesting about the youth that I'm learning, Judge O'Hanlon, in working with them, is that the youth are very disinterested in religion, and that where when we were coming up, religion really molded your politics. Politics is now molding your religion. It's such an interesting shift that people are changing their affiliations based on political topics.
It's the lowest percentage of people going to church that we've ever seen in the United States of America. Mm. It's just a different world now. But I will tell you that the most difficult thing of being a judge, because when I became a judge, we did everything. It wasn't you just did, if somebody wanted to get divorced or if somebody just shot someone else. They all came in front of the judges. Now we have someone that does people that are married, but they wish they weren't married, and so they go to this small group of people go to the judge and they handle those kind of divorces. But we do all the rest of them. And one of the things that I found when I became a judge is that your whole time when you're growing up with your mother and your father and your brothers and sisters and teachers is, stop hurting people. Well, guess what? That's what I do for a living. If he's sitting there going to prison or not going to prison, and his mother, his father, his wife, his kids are sitting there with him, and I've got to say, sorry, it's your third time of doing, stealing something from Kroger's, and you're going to have to go to prison this time. It's difficult to do that, and I found it was difficult to do this, but in the end, you have to do it. Otherwise, you'd keep letting him go, and he'd keep going in and stealing again and again until finally you have to stop him.
I think that that's one area that clergy and judges probably have a lot in common. It's very hard to tell people truth, especially if it's unpopular and it's going to hurt people. Because at your heart and your core, you don't want to hurt people.
But if you're a judge, unlike if you're a pastor, every judge has to make one of the two unhappy every time. So no matter what, one of them's going to go out going, yippee, and the other one's going out going, why, he was terrible. And the one who's going out and saying yippee, most of them are saying, I did it. not me, Dan. I did it. And of course that judge did that. It's the only way you could do it. Of course he did what I told him to do because I was right.
Right.
So I get the bad part put on me. That's what judges do.
How do you resolve that within yourself? That must be mentally very draining.
This will be the most surprising, I think, but the best thing I ever did as a judge, and that's this. David Lockwood was an older lawyer, and he was across the street, and he became a friend of mine, and he would advise me on things. And so he came to me after I had been on the bench for just a year, and I had gained 19 pounds, and I was stressed constantly, worried about this. Did I do this right? I got to read something else, this, that, and the other. And he said, listen, there are three judges down the hall from you, and all of them have had heart attacks, some of them more than one. This is a stressful thing. You have to stop. You have to lose that weight. You have to go tonight and join the YMCA. And Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, when you're done here, you need to go over there, work out, you know, sit in the tub afterwards or sit in the sauna and calm down. And you know, it worked. It took me 3 years, but I lost that 19 pounds down to 170. And I stayed like that for the rest of my career. Never had a heart problem, never had any problems. My physician says I'm the only patient he has over 70 that doesn't have anything wrong with him in here. Because we go and we take it out of our mind and we do something else. By the time I went home, I wasn't worried about what happened that day.
Wow.
So it really changed my life, and I think it will change everybody's life. If you don't go to church, I think that's another thing that lets you, you know, put it aside and say, God, I know you'll help me. And they feel better because they feel like that's happening. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful feeling. But if you don't do that, then you'll never have that wonderful feeling.
That's something that Doug and I do prioritize. We prioritize our physical health because we recognize that there is a direct correlation with mental health and physical health. For us, there just is.
Well, and you can say, oh, you know what? I'm tired. I don't want to go to the YMCA today. Same thing. You can say, you know what? I'm tired of going to church. I'm just going to skip this week. And then pretty soon you're skipping a month. And then pretty soon you're not going anymore. So you just, it's something that you do because it's good for you.
Yes. It's a discipline.
Yeah. And if you don't, then you're walking down the hall and you fall over with a heart attack.
Yeah.
And sad.
Well, you and Doug both read this book, and I haven't had the privilege yet. It was called,
The Fourth Turning.
The Fourth Turning. Tell me a little bit about that book. It sounds intriguing to me.
It is a fascinating story about someone who basically studied generations of people, because my generation is very different from the generation before me, and the one before that, and the one before that. But when they looked at it over a long period of time, this person, Neil Howe, H-O-W-E, had discovered that it's every 80 years, there are four 20-year type of people, generations, and the first generation, you go 80 years later, the first generation of the next one is very similar to what that one was way back when. So he wrote it, and it came out in 1998, and he said, one of the problems we're going to have is the fourth turning, the fourth of these generations, it's always a bad one. And so he said that, if you look for 2020, it's going to be a bad 10 years, maybe longer. And he said, if you go back from 2020, 80 years, it's 1940. That was World War II. If you go back 80 years from that, it's 1860. That's the Civil War in the United States. You go back another 60 years, and guess what? We're fighting with England to become the USA. So every 80 years, something like that is really bad, and you better be careful and make it good. Otherwise, the whole thing will fall apart. Civil War could have split the United States in half if the South had won. It would be a very, very different place now. And now they're even talking like we need a novel Civil War. I mean, you see this if you just open up the internet. You can see it everywhere. We don't have to listen to what Washington, D.C. says. We're going to do what we say. And so it's happening again. And then all over the world, Russia's now going into Ukraine and blowing them up and trying to take it, and says they're going into Poland and they're going back in and taking a lot of these places back. Well, this sounds like World War III to me. So that's what this book is about. It warned me well in advance.
So what preparations, like, for example, I work with 20-something-year-olds, and Judge, one thing that I have learned with my own children, our own teenage children, and then the students that I work with, is they receive information so differently than he and I receive it. You and I will go to, you know, what we find to be a reputable source, and usually read. We read a post or read a.
You mean you're not on TikTok?
I'm not.
But there's your problem.
I say that. That's how my sons receive their information.
Sure is.
And it's hard. It's hard. You know, my one of my children, just 2 or 3 days ago, we had a very spirited debate about something that he had received on TikTok that we just fundamentally disagreed on. Well, but what's interesting to me that I'm finding is that they get their information in 2 to 3 minute snippets. They won't read and then cross reference. It's very interesting. So how do we communicate to that generation?
First thing you might want to tell them is that TikTok comes from China and they hate our guts.
Yes.
And they will throw stuff in there that will throw you off, but you'll believe it because it was on TikTok. Must be true. Mm-hmm. No, it isn't. And they don't check to see if it's true. They just believe that because it's on TikTok and so-and-so did it. They don't know who so-and-so is. So-and-so could be somebody in China that's being paid to put all this stuff on there to tell them all the wrong things and turn them against their families, turn them against the government, turn them against anybody. So it's a terrifying thing. And they're actually talking about turning it off in the United States. And boy, there's going to be some screaming and yelling and crying if they do.
Absolutely. Even rooted down to our 10-year-old. Our 10-year-old wants to have a TikTok account. I'm like, absolutely not. You know, and what's interesting, our justice is the only voice of reason. He was like, you know, they're being sued, you know, right now. You know what I mean? He understands the concept that you just laid out. But it's hard to have conversations with those 20-somethings because they view us as old fogies that we don't understand. You know, there's nothing new under the sun, right? But I find that the content that at least they're tapping into, the vein that they keep tapping into, is a very divisive, angry. It's a very angry message that they're trying to pump into our kids.
And the scary thing I realized, because I went to schools that were involved with my church, was that God doesn't come and solve everything for you. Mm. Doesn't. He allowed his son to be murdered on a cross. He didn't stop it. There's some reason that he knows things need to happen, and he's not just going to go in and make everything perfect and everything will be fine and your kids will all come tomorrow and say, oh, God told me that I was wrong and you were right, so I'm never going to look at TikTok again. That's not going to happen. That's not how the world works. And God has his reasons for letting us try to figure it out ourselves. Wouldn't he be happy when we finally died and went up to heaven and say, I'd like to get in, and they look and say, yeah, you're somebody who really did get it, and you did understand it, and, you know, I just said there's 10 things you have to do, and you did all 10 of them. Congratulations. Not 7 of them, not 4 of them, not none of them. So, you know, he's not asking us to do a lot, but he is asking us to do some things, and we need to respect that and do that. And I don't know how you get that across to them, especially because the generations now are stopping to going to church, so they never hear that. Nobody reminds them of that. You know, sometimes I got thinking, why is it that we go once a week? And then I thought as I grew up, it's because if you wait longer than a week, you're going to start to, well, you know what, I'll go next week. And then I began to see people come on Wednesday night too. And I got, what's that all about? And I said, there are some people that have had a rough life and they got to go twice a week. Not everybody, but there are some people that do better because God bless them for doing that. But they got to go twice a week. See, I mean, it came across to me. Mm-hmm. So, and frankly, we really need to do it every day of our life.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, Marshall said just today, he said, Mom, when you said that the youth are no longer prioritizing faith, that's one question that I ask a lot, because it's my job to try to capture the 20-something-year-old. Because at this age, 18 to 20-something-year-old, the ones that were drugged to church by their parents, they're now at an age where they make the decision on their own. And all too often, they're deciding, not for me, and I'm walking away. And I often ask Marshall, so what is it? I mean, you're in a secular college. You're in a fraternity. Most of the people that you associate with are not Christians. What is it? And he said, Mom, he said, I want you to think about something. He said, we can't sit in a sermon and not criticize and judge each other. Mm-hmm. He said, do you really think that anyone who doesn't look like us or act like us is going to feel comfortable coming in and feeling they're not going to be judged?
And remember, there's no religion in China.
Right.
There's TikTok, but no religion over there. Matter of fact, they were killing and throwing them in prisons and everything else. The one place that was all religious. They're not Chinese, but they're over there, and China's taken over their country, and now they're getting rid of them. They don't want religions over there.
Hmm. That's so interesting. So what do you foresee as for our future?
The next, I'd say, 15 years are going to be really tough. They're going to get tougher during 2020 to 2030. That's when we're going to find out. And we're certainly going to find a lot of it out this coming year. Is it going to be Biden, or is it going to be somebody else other than Biden because he passes out or something at the last minute and they send somebody else? But right now it looks like it's him versus Trump. They're very close to each other if you look at the states, but he just really squeaked past 4 years ago, and Trump still doesn't accept that it happened. But anyway, the chances are that Trump's ahead right now, and if Trump goes back in, this is going to be a very different country in a very different world. He's already said he's going to call Putin and say, hey, these people didn't do what I told them to do over there. Do you want Germany? Go take them. That's a very different kind of thing, that if he goes in, we'll have a very different kind of time than if he doesn't go in.
What do you think, when you said something that leapt in my spirit, when you're referring to the book that you both read and the different blocks of time, and there are similarities, and there's all this civil unrest that leads to something almost like a pendulum that knocks things off course.
Correct.
What is it that the people are discontent with? What is it they're looking for, that they're trying to find in these quasi-saviors of politicians or leaders or whatever? What are they looking for?
They're looking for something that isn't like it is. They're not happy with what it's like. They're not happy with what it was like for their family, for the country. They're getting really picky about it, and they find something wrong about nearly everything they don't like. And then they get on, and enough people agree with them that they think, well, I'm absolutely right. And these are people they've never met, people they have no idea if they're right or wrong, or if they're, they don't even know who these people are. They just see them on TikTok or someplace else on the internet. And that's a whole different world.
How do we bridge that gap? I was talking to a lady today, and we were actually talking about church, and it led to politics, and that seems to be happening so often recently. One tends to bleed into the other. And I mentioned her, the ticket probably will look very similar as it did the last presidential, or with Biden and a Trump ticket. And she said, let me tell you my experience. It was probably different than yours. She said, I'm an independent, but most people think because I'm a Christian, I'm a Republican. And I had Democratic individuals that I work with that just would attack me and clump me into this weird grouping. She says it was horrible. They just assumed things about me and my political ideologies based on me being a Christian. They never asked even what my affiliation was. And I had a similar experience where I remember it being said from the pulpit, you couldn't possibly be a spirit-filled Christian and be a Democrat. And I was. I am. And I think it's so interesting when you say that they just assume things and they're looking for something. How do we get to the place where we actually change our perception and communicate, and more importantly, coexist with people that may not agree with us or see things the way we see it?
Hold your breath and wait 15 more years. Because these people are going to get stronger and stronger, and you're going to get weaker and weaker, and you're going to get retired, and they're going to be running things. And they're going to be the ones that are in charge. They're going to be the ones that are in the legislatures. They're going to be the ones that are in the mayor's jobs. They're the ones that are going to be the presidents and things of that nature. I mean, can you imagine that we've been all these hundreds of years and we still don't have a woman as president of the United States? That's going to change. Now, people may not like that. Older people may think, whoa, this is horrible. That's not, she should be home taking care of her children. But it's going to, everything's going to change. Things are going to change that you can't believe could possibly change. But that's what's coming. That's the end of the fourth turning.
And that's inevitable.
That's happened so far, yeah. Every 80 years.
So just hold on, huh?
Hold on.
Hold on tight. 15 more. Hopefully we can make it 15 more, Judge.
It'll be something different, but lots of people. If there's another World War III, this time they've got nuclear weapons. They've got there'll be a lot more people gone and a lot more cities gone and a lot more things gone. And how you make that up afterwards, we hope that God is helping us.
Amen. Amen.
All right.
Well, Judge,
you.
We really appreciate your time. It was very valuable, and we appreciate you spending it with us. Absolutely. Well, thank you, table listeners, and as always, we will see you next week.
We hope you are enjoying today's show. We believe that God has given us a voice to impact communities and regions all over the world. If you would like to make sure that voice is heard, please partner with us today by visiting www.expressionradio.org and click donate. You can also text give by texting the dollar amount followed by the word radio to the number 84321. First-time text givers, please choose Expression Church of Huntington when prompted. All gifts are tax deductible. Join us as we change the world.